So, I'm going to talk to you about a piece of legislation that we call New York Health, a single-payer plan for the state of New York. This is put together by Richard Gottfried, who is the chair of the Health Committee in our assembly. And these slides were put together by Bob Padgug, a policy analyst at Brooklyn College, and myself. And what I'd like to do is just describe the act to you, because I think this is a way you could get started in your own state. If you could get a state legislator to put together a bill, this might be the kind of bill that you'd want to put together. And we're very willing to share with you the details of it. So, it is a bill, you can see the name of it. It provides comprehensive health coverage, and the emphasis is on doing that for all New Yorkers. And so what I'm going to do is talk about these constituents of the bill so that you get a sense of what's in it. In terms of eligibility, every resident of New York State is eligible to enroll. This is undoubtedly a complex and controversial issue because we have a lot of undocumented in the state of New York, and yet a lot of them are getting medical care now, largely through our safety net institutions. So we think it's very important to have this every resident, regardless of age, income, wealth, or employment. And this program will not be funded by premiums, and we have excluded the notion of deductibles and copayments. This conforms very much with H.R. 676 in some ways, but we think that copays and deductibles are a very crude way of trying to control demand, and we've got to think much more creatively, largely, again, because these financial incentives equally retard needed with unneeded care. And the consequence frequently is, in fact, higher costs rather than lower costs. What's the benefit structure? Essentially, the notion of comprehensive benefits, choice of providers, yes, the coverage of inpatient hospital care, physician, nurse practitioner, outpatient care in general, an emphasis on primary and preventive care, prescription drug coverage, dental, vision, and hearing care, things, by the way, that are not well covered by the Medicare program. And then the general notion that you can choose your primary care provider, but really a very important principle we felt was to say that you could also choose your specialty care provider. In other words, the primary care provider does not operate as a gatekeeper, but in fact is there to assist you to get all necessary care and medical follow-up. In essence, the primary care physician is a navigator to help you negotiate our crazy and complicated healthcare system. And making the point that no insurance company should stand between you and your physician. In terms of reimbursement, we again think in terms of paying all providers in full without copays, as I mentioned earlier, or other charges to patients. Yes, develop some new reimbursement methods to replace the current wasteful fee-for-service system. But in fact, the law is not specific about precisely what those reimbursement methods will be. One could imagine in a primary care practice, for instance, having what I call a hybrid system of partial capitation and fee-for-service. But these rates would be negotiated by New York Health with essentially healthcare provider organizations. How would this be funded? No premiums, no deductibles, no copays. no insurance company, regressive taxes, such as premiums. You know how premiums operate, right? The president of the company pays the same premium as the secretary in the company, but in fact their incomes are so widely different that it becomes highly regressive if you in fact base your financing on premiums. And this notion, kind of an interesting one, Medicare, as you all know, its Part A is funded by a flat tax, right? Well, we wanted to move a little bit away from the flat tax idea and therefore thought in terms of a graduated or progressive payroll tax, okay? So that you would have a different percent for people, a lower percent for people with low incomes and a higher percent for people with higher incomes. And we think that's a really interesting idea, again, in part because payroll tax-based funding provides the consumer some way of kind of estimating what this plan is going to cost me. It's not hidden. It's something you can go out and use your calculator and actually figure out. So a progressive graduated tax that would be 80% paid by the employer, 20% by the employee, 100% for self-employed individuals, a small income tax surcharge, and potentially, definitely getting rid of existing premiums. The existing federal funds would be used for New York Health. In other words, one would get a waiver that would allow you to fold in Medicare and Medicaid federal monies, as well as our programs called Family and Child Health Plus. There would be, of course, as I say here, federal waivers necessitated, which clearly means that this program would have difficulty getting funded before 2017. But it's not, it's where one kind of looks forward to things. And then the local share of Medicaid funding, that is to say the state, our state actually funds the program not just from state contributions, but also from county contributions, interestingly. Those would essentially be ended. And then finally, all state and federal revenues would be put into a New York Health Trust Fund that would be used only for putting or paying for health care. Interestingly, you'll notice some things are left out of this. For instance, long-term care, which is funded very much by the Medicaid program in the state of New York, that would be kept separate at the outset, but the law states that it needs to be researched and developed within a 5-year period. The reason we left it out is that it is one of the more difficult things to figure out the costing of, and thought it better to make this a stepwise approach. As I mentioned earlier, the specific nature of how physicians, hospitals, and so on will be reimbursed are left a little bit more vague in the bill itself. Again, our sense is that those things and those details may, in fact, be important to work out later. However, we're very clear that we would exclude private insurance from duplicating the benefits that are in the New York Health Plan. Why a plan like this now? Is it really possible, frankly, to think in terms of New York going for a state single-payer plan? It's certainly there are questions about that. But what's interesting about this kind of thing from a political point of view, if you're interested in how to raise issues related to single-payer, this is one way to actually begin to discuss the principles and the specifics that I've just laid out for you. It really is a great way to begin to raise these questions, and it allows you to develop an organizing process and then allows you to go to state legislators and actually lobby them to sign on to this bill. The fact that we've got a bill in the assembly is really important. And one of the ways we do that is that we begin to target state legislators who we think will eventually potentially run for Congress in their area. Okay, so that this has implications beyond just the state, because if in fact they sign on as a co-sponsor of the state bill, when they become congresspeople, we can say, you signed on to the state bill, how about signing on to something like 676, a federal bill? So there is built into this the notion of a political strategy over the long term. And even if we don't get a bill in New York State, what it allows us to do, we don't get a law, I guess you'd say, in New York State, it allows us, in fact, to be working politically toward getting something from our state legislature. So let me stop there and open this panel to your questions and comments. But what I hope what we've done is given you a sense of what really is happening around the country, and also something within New York State, which is a political strategy for working on these issues.
Ollie, can we take a quick show of hands to see where people are from?
Sure.
How many from the East Coast?
Wow.
How many from the West Coast? Middle of the country? Alaska, Hawaii?
So what we've got, is pretty equal, I guess a little bit less from the middle of the country. It should be said that if there's anybody from Minneapolis or Minnesota here, there is a very active group in that state working on state single-payer issues. And they actually have had a Lewin study done the way California did, but their study was done in March of this year, showing that they could save about $190 billion in this very efficient state, the efficient state of Minnesota, if they went from their multi-payer system to a single-payer one. So, questions, comments? Yes, let's go over here. You want to start with Lamont and here.
Any of the in our state would require a cultural revolution to send specialists back to the fields.
It's a concern everywhere to have enough primary care. The University of Vermont is our only medical school, and it does not get much less, around 10% funding from the legislature, so it's not tied in where we can really push for increasing the number of primary care physicians. That being said, it's felt to be one of the better schools for educating primary care, but still it's less than 20% graduating.
We definitely have a workforce problem in Hawaii too, but there are a number of ways I think this would help. One is that right now we train medical students and residents primarily in Medicaid funding. They're exposed to the worst aspect of Medicaid managed care there, which is a strong deterrent for them going into primary care. And I think if we could get rid of the Medicaid managed care system and implement a physician-driven quality improvement program for Medicaid, train them in that context, and take away a lot of the administrative barriers to going into private practice, it would be much easier to recruit doctors to do primary care than stay in the state. Our medical school is very primary care focused, but even for the reasons I just said, a lot of them end up not going to primary care because it's too scary to do so, given the daunting things they have to deal with. If we can remove the barriers, I think we would have a big shot at improving workflow.
I'll concur with those comments and just add two financial considerations. One is that in the UN analysis, in various analyses, what happens to physician offices if you remove the administrative burden? Physicians save about 8% of their time that they don't have to spend on paperwork, which turns out to be very similar to the additional clinical time they need to add to provide services to the uninsured. So it's true we need to train more people, but in the meantime, there's an approximate balance in the shift of paths. The other element that I think is under the control of single payer is directed by the primary care specialist reimbursement mismatch that we have now, imbalance that we have now.
Let me say, Larry Catalino, in one of his studies, actually shows that about $65,000 is spent on paperwork in terms of the time of the clinician. That particularly the primary care clinician has to put in, and so we'd have that savings again if we could rearrange their time and get it away from paperwork. I will say that when Vermont kind of said we're on a pathway to single payer, we had over 200 medical students from the Northeast congregate in Montpelier at the Capitol and said, if you pass a single payer bill, we'll come and practice in the state of Vermont. So maybe, in fact, they'll go to Hawaii if you're the person that didn't do that. No. Yes, you had a question.
States, in those systems, there are multiple fiscal agents. for profit. They provide exactly the same benefit package. Doctors deal with only one formulary. All the elements of our system today which don't work and which will be resolved under single payer are also resolved. The only difference being, instead of having in a way, you could look and say, if we have 50 single payer systems, one for each state, that would be kind of similar to having 50 fiscal aids that are not for profit. So I think it's a little bit definitional, but it's still simpler to have the government take that role. But if you could in the United States have not for profit fiscal aids who only just sell insurance and pay the bill using the same form for everyone, then it would be very similar.
What you described is what I call an all payer system, where you have the same delivery system, just different funding schemes into the same income. I think that would solve, 80 to 90% of the problem. Countries that have all payer systems are still more expensive, they're less efficient to run the single payer system. Switzerland, we just heard from someone from Switzerland in the CNHP a couple of days ago, and they're thinking of scrambling their multi-payer all-payer system because there are really no advantages to having multiple payers. All it does is add cost without value. And their system is, there's so many plans and they really accomplish nothing by having multiple plans. Everything they need would be accomplished simpler and more efficiently with only one plan. And Switzerland has the most competing plans in any other country besides the U.S. and they're the second most expensive system in the world. So, yeah. It would help, but the Hawaii idea is we'll start with all payer because that way you don't have to boot out all the insurance companies. You just change them from being insurance plans to fiscal agents for an all payer system. So it's a transitional program, but you would want to get beyond that to pull some payers if you could.
And actually, frankly, what we see in the transitional plan in Vermont is very similar to that. It's just that you don't have a lot of payers. That you're going to use a single type to pay standard benefit package. So, in fact, a lot of those concepts are in what we're talking about, except that I think the vision overall still remains kind of a single payer one. Any other?
Sure.
I also think it's helpful in trying to raise awareness in the public to use the term single payer. Because if you don't, then it becomes a demonized term by the other side. But if you use it openly and keep explaining what it is and educate people about it, you inoculate the community against that kind of prejudice, which is what Vermont has been doing very effectively.
Right. By having, again, these grassroots groups like the Vermont Worker Center actually talking about this issue, yes.
These kinds of programs would clearly, the political feasibility of them would clearly depend to some degree on political support within the individual states and what it might not do to their incomes. So I wonder if you could speak to that. And perhaps also to the question of Republican support in the New York State Senate.
Okay, well, I can say that has been a barrier in New York State. No question of the fact that we have a divided. A Senate that's Republican controlled and an assembly that's democratically controlled. And that's why there's never been, in fact, an act fully voted upon, even though the assembly has, by the way, passed the bill entirely a few years ago. What about physician support for this? What I would point out is that interesting article in the Annals of Internal Medicine, where, in fact, physicians were surveyed from the AMA master file, and 59% of physicians favored a national health insurance program. It wasn't single payer in the terms that were used, but a national health insurance program. There is more sympathy for this, I think, than many people recognize. Yes, it is very specialty divided. Interestingly, the psychiatrists in that study were the ones that had the highest percentage of interest, but they were followed by pediatricians, internal medicine, family medicine.
Sounds like it's inversely related to the
income. Well, there's an interesting question. That may well be true, and it's very possible that those primary care providers will do better under a single-payer approach.
I just wanted to say that my experience in Hawaii has been surprising in this regard, because I got elected president of the Hawaii Medical Association on a people care platform. We got a large majority of the council, which is mostly specialists, supported. And I think a lot of that has to do with my own advocacy and ability to sell the idea. I think Vermont has had something similar with Deb Richter and others who have been spent a lot of time talking to other doctors about what it would mean. It's a barrier that can be overcome, but it requires some effort and some education.
I'd just like to say that in Vermont, we've done surveys back as far as 94, and that's shown that all of the residents, we only have a one residency program. The majority, close to 64%, were in favor of single payer. I think Steve's inoculation method is really crucial. Single payer isn't a dirty word.
All right, we are by on the 4 o'clock hour, so please come up if you have additional questions. I hope this session has been helpful to you and expanded your knowledge about programs in states and also expanded your imagination about what's possible. Thanks so much.